Now, Podcast One brings you Spike's Car Radio, a downloadable cars and coffee hosted by writer, comedian, and automotive enthusiast Spike Ferriston. Now, here's Spike.
Excellent. Welcome to Spike's Car Radio, everybody. We got a good show today, Zuckerman. It's going to be good. Hot Rodder, Rod Emery, is going to be here. Is he? He's a hot rodder, right? Porsche outlaw guy.
He is, and I'm going to tell you something.
Owner proprietor of Emery Motorsports.
And what guess are you going to what? Tell me? I've never met the guy.
And you've never met Rod. Well, great.
I've never met Rod. You would think a guy with the money I have and the shit he has to get, he would have been exciting.
Look, we're already. Do you think there's a possibility he might extract money out of you today?
Well, he should be looking at me like a sautéed pork chop right now. Someone to pluck a chicken.
And this is going to happen now. If I took you down to his shop, I've been there many times, and I love Rod. He's a sweetheart of a guy, and his work is unparalleled. His outlaw work, I love it. If you go down to that shop, and I've never had an appetite to buy one of his cars or to have one of them outlawed, you go down to the shop, you're dead. You immediately see what he's doing, and you want. Yeah, anyway.
You want it, but I think he also is a great restorer, too.
He is. We're going to get into all that, Zuckerman. I don't want to get too far ahead of it. Look, I was at – have you been down to the L.A. Auto Show?
I know. There's people there. I don't want to be there.
I never want to go to this thing either, and Porsche called me up and said, please come down and look at our Porsche thing that we got going on.
Do you know
there.
What it makes me feel like to be with slow-moving people, shuffling their feet? Their feet are barely leaving the carpet, and
yes.
You're stuck in the midst of all of that
who
humanity.
Want to talk. They all want to get around, and they want to chit-chat. You know, you're forgetting about the fact that your feet hurt because you walk 10 miles before you see the first car, and your skin gets hot like copy paste. And, you know, somehow you're sweating and cold at the same time.
And then you ask me if I want to go there.
Yeah, let's go. Because they get cars.
There's no way.
Well, let me tell you what they had down there. They had, and this is really interesting to me, the cars that we like, and Porsche has its own wing. And you walk in and you see everybody from Magnus to all the Porsche guys. I know Rod, I'm sure, was there. And they had the GT2 RS.
Okay.
On one side, and they had this in their little lineup there. They had the GT2 RS. On the far end of these three cars, they had the Touring Package GT3, which I sat in and
very
I played
exciting.
With. And in between it, they had the 911T, the new Touring entry-level lightest 911. You know the car I'm talking about, right?
Last time I said they are going to be a mass producer of specialty vehicles.
But isn't that interesting that they put that car between these two
because
great cars?
Because it's new. It's something that the average person can actually afford that's special.
That's special, right?
Everyone wants special. No one wants to be normal. No one wants
I
regular.
I think this is a car for the purist on a budget, right? The Porsche purist on a budget. It had the little fabric door pulls. It just looked like between the three cars sitting there, that would be the one I would probably drive 200,000 miles
right.
on.
It does kind of remind me of an RS America 964.
Yeah,
It's not much of anything but door pulls and a couple of gimmicks.
Right. I sat in the GT2 RS, by the way.
And?
It makes you crazy. It instantly makes you crazy. It's one of the most beautiful creations ever. It's insane. I predict that you and I are splitting one, right? We're
yes.
still doing that?
Yes.
I predict we put about 700 miles on it total.
It's going to be one of those, huh?
It's one of those. It's going to be the greatest thing to drive twice a year. But
like a Carrera GT?
Like a Carrera GT?
Or an
no,
RS
no, no,
4.
A lot easier 0. Than a Carrera GT.
Oh, yeah, RS
But
4.
Somewhere 0. Between a GT3 RS, this last version, and a Carrera GT. That's where I'd put this in the drivability category.
Right.
What do you think?
Well, you know what? I don't disagree with you. 700 horsepower designed to go around the ring 10 seconds faster than the 918. It doesn't sound like it was really
where
designed.
Where are we doing that around here? Have you ever been in a GT2? But I've been on the track in a GT2, and both times it scared the crap out of me. Because I'd be blasting around at like 80 miles an hour, just have a little kink in the track, and I would lose the back end of the car. And I would go, what?
Where do you feel that? Do you feel that in the lower part of your bowels, your stomach, or your heart?
But it terrifies me. Cars like that terrify me on the track because it just in a moment when you're not thinking, like you, a road rager, an accomplished road rager, in a moment when you're not thinking, you might take that right into a telephone pole.
Okay, I have a great idea for this LA car show.
Yes.
We get two cardboard cutouts of ourselves, and we send those to the car show, and we have pictures taken. Look, our cardboard cutouts are enjoying that car.
Yes, they are enjoying the car. Well, I'll tell you what else was very prominent was plug-in vehicles were everywhere. I don't know if I showed you, but they have Range Rovers and Range Rover Sports that you plug into an electrical thing.
What does that do to Tesla? What is it?
Everybody was showing, especially Volkswagen, who was in deep shit over the diesel scandal. Rolling out like 50 electric vehicles. And it's coming on strong. But the most off-putting image for me was this Range Rover autobiography or whatever it was. Range Rover plug that you plug it into the wall.
Can you imagine what that does to the lights? Talk about a brownout.
It just didn't seem what Range Rover was all about, right? It seemed odd.
So
but
to me.
I don't know. I guess we're all going to have to
get used
to
that. Are the Mission E cars plug-in or they somehow charge themselves?
Ooh, that's a good question. They can't charge themselves. They're all electric. That's not possible, right?
I don't know.
No. But, interesting that Tesla last week or 2 weeks ago rolled out that little Tesla two-seater that they say is going to be faster than the Mission E. I couldn't help but think that that was a direct attack on the Mission E. Do you know the car I'm talking about?
I'm very impressed with this Elon Musk dude. Did you read the Rolling Stone article about him? He's weird.
I'm not going to spend any time on this guy.
He's weird. He's emotional, but he does. he does change the world.
Well, I don't have it in front of me, but I thought I read it was this car, this Roadster, this new one is 0 to 60 in 1.9 seconds.
What does that do to your bowels?
Well, I just wonder if it's – I mean, there's a lot of conjecture on whether it's real or not, whether that's a real car or whether that could really happen. But that's pretty fast, Z. 1.9 seconds?
Well, we get to teleportation. That's what we're eventually going to be. Yeah, you're going to be there faster than time.
At what point do you accelerate so quickly that you die? That's my question.
Well, let's just take a look at Abbott and Costello go to the moon.
All right. Well, Rod Emery's here. I can see him walking in. Here he comes right now. He's very excited. Hi, Rod.
How you doing?
Good
Rod
to see
Emery,
you.
How are you? Good.
Do you know the real Zuckerman, Paul Zuckerman?
We've never officially met. But not for real.
Really?
Sit down and get on a mic. So you know him virtually. You see him on Instagram.
I do.
Yeah.
I do.
Keep close to the mic there.
Okay.
What do you like about Zuckerman's feed?
I'll put him on the spot. Thank you.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, exactly. Tell the truth. No, what I like about it is great photography, right?
And it's okay.
And amazing cars.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, which, you know, it's for me, that's what it's about. I mean,
right.
I love Instagram just because it gives us all an opportunity to kind of peek into each other's little keyholes.
I know what he likes the
peek
best.
Peek into our keyhole, Zuckerman.
Peeking. I like peeking and peeping.
Peeping. No, let's not talk about peeping.
Peeping through keyholes.
But I know which one he likes the best.
Which one?
The 59 Carrera GT, the ice racer. Mm. I would guess. Maybe right, maybe wrong.
You know, that is. That's a pretty slick little car,
yeah.
You know. I think the first time I saw that car was at Dana Point a few years ago.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I found it in a magazine. And sent it to Seinfeld, as I often do. Things I can't afford. Can you buy this? And he bought it. And somehow this clown ended up with it.
Yeah, and well, you
have
know,
you ever put the ice the spike tires on it?
To go where?
I don't know. that might be the first thing that I do is put spike tires on that thing and drive
around
LA.
Well, of course, Spike would put spike tires on it, right?
You know?
This is the – now, who is the racer in that car? Simon Bostrom. Bostrom, Swedish ice racing car. It had thin little tires on it. And if you imagine, like, what, 2 or 3 inch spikes on it, and it would race around in these ice racing competitions in Sweden. Right?
Yeah.
Do I have it right?
Yep. Yep.
Wow.
And someone put those spikes in the tires. Those were put on by hand, right?
Yeah. They're hammered through basically from the inside. They're amazing.
So how does that work? You hammer it. How does that not make the tire flat?
Well, there's a couple different. Yeah. There's a couple.
That's a good question.
Yeah,
Why are you laughing at that?
Because it's just funny.
There's a lot of different ways they do them. I mean, sometimes they're screws. They go in from the outside, and then a lot of times when they do spike them through the inside, then they put a liner on the inside that that then will keep like the tube from being punctured. So
are there? Yeah, I know. How many ice racing 356s are out there?
Not very many, but you know, Jeff Zwart's little Gamund was a Swedish ice racing.
His
car.
Was too.
It was. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't
and that,
know that.
That car's in my shop right now. So that was a Swedish ice racer before it came here.
It's hard to say Swedish ice.
Swedish.
How do those Swedish things? How does the Gamund drive?
Like a 49 Volkswagen.
Really?
No, I mean they're pretty amazing little cars. I mean they're really lightweight. Like the SLs.
Right.
Well, you know. The 356 SL that I restored, you know, the Le Mans winning cars got a lot of camshaft, right? So it's a lot of slip in the clutch and you know, the car's really lightweight. You know, a regular Gamund is a little bit more, you know, civilized. It's got a little bit more interior and the engine is a little easier to drive. Mm-hmm. So it drives like an old Volkswagen.
Okay, but can you feel the 356-ness in it?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's going to have you know, a 356 just runs a little smoother than a Volkswagen, just the way that, you know, just everything about them, the way that the mm-hmm. car is put together. But when you're driving them, I mean, you can't deny the fact that it's a 356.
So, you Rod, know? You know, we were just
There's
talking
so
about the LA Auto Show.
Yep.
Well, you were down there. I saw on your feed.
No, I was at the Porsche Design launch at the new Porsche Design store. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So,
do you go to the LA Auto Show? Do you like auto shows?
You know, I kind of steer away from the auto shows
again,
a little bit.
Another one.
Why do you steer away?
Because I'm in the shop. 4 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Right.
And I'm banging away on cars. And,
so
and,
what do you,
and most of the guys that I really want to see will come and visit me.
Right,
so,
right. You know. How do you – if you're working that hard, how many Instagram posts are you doing a day? Like I try to do maybe one or two maybe. I feel piggish with two, right?
I do about two. Every once in a while three if I'm really excited just to kind of keep people engaged in what we're doing.
Yeah, no, it's a huge following. Well, I want to start with you at the beginning. You know, you're a third-generation builder.
Generation.
I am, yeah.
Emery Motorsports started with you, right? And
it
your
did.
Wife. But what was going on back in the beginning? Who's grandpa?
Yeah.
What was his deal?
Well, my grandpa, Neil Emery, grew up in Burbank. And in the early – well, he was born in the 20s and had 1912. But he went to – you know, high school, went all the way through school here in Burbank.
Uh-huh.
And when he was 12 years old, or 11 years old, he was delivering newspapers in Toluca Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And then met somebody that was over at Warner Brothers that had their car parked in a dirt parking lot when he was in high school. And he said, hey, you know, can I clean your car for you? And then he noticed that everybody else's cars were just as dirty. So he had a little card box and he was detailing cars in the Warner Brothers parking lot.
In
the 20s.
Wow.
Right?
But the world was made of dirt.
Yep. And he's cleaning the cars, right?
Charlie
Chaplin's
car, right?
And then
who
a couple
else has
of
a car at that point?
Couple, yeah.
Keystone Cops.
There were a handful of guys. And, you know, and of course they were all dark colors and, you know. So and then what happened was these guys were like, hey, you know, can you take it and get the oil changed?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he didn't even have a driver's license. But it just kind of led into this thing where he's kind of, you know, facilitating the service and maintenance on some of these cars. And then next thing you know, can you customize it a little bit? And that led to just his love for cars and being mm-hmm. around them. And then, you know, the war came and he was enlisted, went to Alameda Military Base and thought he was being shipped overseas. My dad was born just shortly after that. But while he was at Alameda, one of the generals crashed their car at night, probably a little bit of shenanigans, you know, and asked if there was anybody that knew anybody in paint.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandfather hadn't really done any, but he raised his hand and said, I'm up for it. He ended up hammering out the fenders, doing the bodywork, and they made him head of the motor pool at Alameda Military Base.
No kidding.
So he never got shipped off to war. Instead, he did the maintenance and repair, and then when the generals had a little spare – when there was a little spare time, he started actually doing some custom work on their cars while he was enlisted. Then,
so he very organically gets it. There's no such thing as an auto body shop and a paint shop back then? Does
well, there
it not
was.
Exist or
yeah.
they're just
– There was,
You need
yeah.
to know a guy. There's no yellow pages or
nah,
anything.
There's no Mako and, you know,
cheap. And I'm thinking about detailing, like no Meguiars, no Prowls.
Yeah, there's no nothing.
Was just,
right.
Was
so he's just inventing
different.
It pretty
he's,
much.
He's kind of just rolling with it, right?
Right.
And so then gets out of – gets.
What is the metal they're banging on back then? Is it aluminum or is it
steel? It's
steel.
Yeah, and it's thick. It's real steel. It's nice and thick, you know. And you had to manhandle it, and so he was banging fenders in the during the war, gets out of the war, and he and his brother-in-law in 1947 decided let's start this business, and they got a little building, kind of actually, it's on the street up from where Leno's place is,
mm-hmm.
It was like this small little tiny building, and started doing some hot rodding and custom car stuff. And then in 1948, his best friend, Dean Batchelor, you guys know that name. He was, you know, editor of Road and Track and one of the most legendary, you know, writers in automotive history and journalism. He had this idea that he wanted to break the land speed record. And in 1948, he sketched an envelope-bodied streamliner and had Alex Exidius, who started SoCal Speed Shop, build the platform, build the chassis and flathead. And then my grandfather –
What is the land speed record at that point? 48 miles an
hour?
Well,
there was a lot of different – there's obviously different classes, but they were going for you know, like an envelope bar, or like a streamliner speed record.
Breaking
with,
a ton, as they
with
say.
With a flathead. And they their goal was to, you know, go 150, 175 miles an hour.
I can't
think
even
about
imagine.
That in those kind of vehicles.
Yeah.
Right.
Boy,
I get nervous at 100.
We were just talking about where you feel fear. What part of your bowels?
Just all of a sudden, yeah, you're just – you're sketched out.
Own guy, your grandpa knew Eddie Meyer and Bud Meyer, all those guys.
All those guys. Because it was all – the hot rodding culture, you know, began right here in the valley, you know, right on the side of the hill in the valley. So Dean said, let's build this thing. So my grandfather built a complete aluminum body, and that's the car that everybody knows as the SoCal Streamliner, which was the first hot rod over 200 miles an hour. And that led into just – you know, my grandfather was a very subtle customizer, but drastic but subtle. So everything he did was hard to pick out. But he really pioneered channeling and sectioning cars. You know, Barris and Winfield and those guys, they chopped tops and, you know, did kind of wild – fins and all kinds of stuff. My grandfather went the kind of hard route to meet out of the middle of the car because he loved the European styling cars. You know, European styling was a lot thinner in the body and a lot sleeker. And, you know, he loved the old Cicitalias. He loved all the, you know, the early pre-war stuff that came out of Europe. And he kind of, introduced some of that styling into the hot rods, custom cars.
Did you get to work with him? And how old were you when that started?
Yeah, so
this is the coolest grandpa story ever, right?
Unbelievable.
So what was your grandfather doing, Zuckerman?
He was driving a cab from 29 to 85.
That's a pretty cool story too. Yeah, that's not bad.
Yeah,
he had one
of those little change things that, you know, like at the carnival where you click out the pennies, nickels. That's what he would give me for Hanukkah. I'd get a change maker.
How cool is that? One of my grandfathers was weights and measures in New Bedford, Massachusetts. So he went around to the delis and made sure no one was putting their thumb on the scales or that gas wasn't. And the other one was a gyno, a doctor, OBGYN. He was a little.
You could have picked that up like Rod.
He never
picked
let me
his,
in.
His skill set.
Well, I did in certain ways, but.
Oh, you know what else? My grandfather gave me one of those balls that you put on the steering wheel.
Oh yeah.
Oh, he gave
Brody
you one of those.
A Brody knob.
Yeah, Brody knob.
They outlawed those things, but they. I still have one on my.
They'd fling off.
I still have
head.
One on my tractor. You know.
Do you
so
really?
That was
farm.
Such a thing in high school. Like, do not put that on your steering wheel because the cops will bust you. I was terrified about that.
Okay. Well, I had a Brody knob at 9. I couldn't do much. With it, nor did man, I had the Brody knob and the change maker, two things I couldn't use.
He used it as a
put it on the outside of your fist, punch somebody in the face. Grandpa takes you under his wing.
Well, so a few years later.
Were you four? Were you two before he started pushing this on you?
Yeah, well, I was kind of born into it. I mean, so
all those pictures of you as a kid, what documentation.
So my grandfather –
what are we talking about?
Come on. You won't – yeah, you follow
me? He doesn't follow me, no.
I do see
– He's got pictures of him at like 3 years old in the coolest cars we want today. He's three. He's in –
Oh, really?
I just missed those pictures. He's hanging off the car.
No. Yeah. I have a question about a photo on your feed, but we're going to get to that in a little bit. Let's get to
that. So, you know, everybody know my history, my family history goes back to custom cars and Fords and Chevys. But then it's like, how did I end up in this Porsche world? And so in 1961, my grandfather, one of his good friends, was a guy, Chick Iverson, that had a little used car lot in Toluca Lake.
Yep.
He had just purchased the Porsche Volkswagen dealership in Newport Beach. And he says, Neil, he said, you know, you're always complaining because nobody wants to do true custom work. They just want to paint cars now because this is now in the 60s. They didn't want to, you know, chop and channel. They just wanted to do crazy paint and, you know, stuff. So he says, and insurance work was coming in. So, you know, and it wasn't the same in the 60s as it was in the 50s, true custom building and hot rodding. So Chick says, come to work for me. So my grandfather packed up the family, moved to Newport Beach, and became the body shop manager of Chick Iverson Volkswagen Porsche. My dad had just graduated high school, so he went to work at the dealership as a detailer and then became parts manager. So You know, my dad's the parts manager. My grandfather's the body shop manager. My uncle is my grandfather's apprentice. So that was in the 60s. And then in the 70s, right before I was born, my dad had an opportunity. He saw that all these Porsche dealerships back then there were dealerships in literally every other city. I mean, there were like 100 in the state of California.
Little teeny things, two, wow. Three cars, mm-hmm. Right?
All over the place. And you know,
so Neil is your grandfather. What's your dad's name?
Gary.
And your uncle is Don?
Is Don, right. Yeah. So
– And how many of them had beards?
All of them.
They were all bearded
except
guys,
for me.
Right?
I'm the only non-bearded guy. So my dad, he's running the parts department, and this is a pretty fascinating story because here's all these Porsches. Porsche was building mm-hmm. 356s, the 912s, 911s, and then later in the 60s they were developing the 914, and then the 914s came out. So there were all these different models, and the cars were changing so rapidly in those years that the parts departments were filling up, literally like exploding with parts. They didn't have any room for them. So all of these little dealerships were sending all the stuff back to these big warehouses. And there was one right here in Los Angeles, which was the largest one, because back then Volkswagen of America controlled and handled all of the parts distribution for Porsche, Volkswagen, and Audi. Mm-hmm. My dad's like, okay, so all these parts are going back. What are they doing with them? They were throwing them away and they were crushing them because they didn't have space. Okay, so imagine four cam engines.
Oh, no.
Imagine pallets of CB hood mounted like Oscar fog lights being crushed.
Ugh.
So my dad was just heartbroken. It gutted him. So he went to Chick and he said, Chick, he said, we have to rescue all these parts. So they struck a deal with Porsche, Volkswagen of America, and they bought all of Porsche, Volkswagen, and Audi distributor obsolescence. So they weren't allowed to cherry pick the stuff. They had to take it all. But they were able to get it for 6 cents on the dollar, right?
Wow.
So imagine being able to take all this stuff. So they rented a big warehouse, which is – you know where Period Correct is in Costa
mm-hmm.
Mesa?
Yeah.
That building was my dad's building starting in the early 70s.
Wow.
So my dad starts packing all these parts in this building and says, Chick, let's sell this stuff. And that's what started Porsche Parts Obsolete, which was the first real vintage, like modern parts for vintage Porsches.
Mm-hmm.
And so in 74, I was born. You know, my dad had a little 66 911 with an IROC tail and, you know, just all kinds of, like, cool parts because he could get stuff immediately, right?
66
he had a 66
IROC.
He had a 66 911.
What the hell? Was that a picnic table?
It was in 74, right?
Right.
So
uh-huh.
So the IROC tail came. So my dad's like, and he had and he had
crazy.
And he had RSR flares on it. And it was just the most badass little 911, right?
Wow.
So
well,
my
the
mom,
flares will balance it
my
out.
My mom's ready to pop. So, you know, he races her to Hogue Hospital. I'm born and races me home in a fat fendered IROC modified 911, right?
66.
A 66. So the whole, you know,
you
now.
Pop that mic in front of you there.
Yeah. So I really was just kind of born into this, you know, as far as the kind of culture. And then by 3, 4, 5 years old, I was in the parts department with my dad. My mom had sent me to work with my dad. And, you know, while everybody else is playing with Legos and Tinker Toys and Lincoln Logs, I was literally in the shop trying to just kind of fit stuff together. And by 8 or 9 years old, my grandfather started showing me how to gas weld. And by 10 years old, I was, rebuilding like small engines. And then when I was 12, I got a job as
10?
Yeah.
10 years old.
This is like a story from the 30s on the farm.
What engine are you rebuilding? Because I have a 10-year-old.
So
he can barely write his name on a piece of paper. What do you mean?
I raced Honda three-wheelers. You remember the old three-wheelers, the little death machines, right?
No, I don't remember those. What are those? Motorcycles?
It's a motorcycle with three wheels, right?
Oh, okay. Trike.
Yeah. So this was early 80s.
Right.
And so my dad got me a little Honda 110. I rebuilt the engine on that. I got a 250R.
What do you mean?
You took it apart by yourself. Next time you talk to my dad, just all you have to say is Honda 250R, and he will tell you a 2-hour story about how he freaked out when he came into my little workshop and saw the engine of my 250R complete. This is a brand new bike, completely apart, gears, crank out.
But
everything.
How did you approach that? Did you know going into this engine rebuild, I'm going to probably screw this up, or did you have someone ask questions?
I was 10. I was the most confident, you know, 10 years. But I had no fear, right?
But you're pulling apart like
Spicoli.
I used to take apart everything in my house just because I was bored. I'd pull apart radios,
but
lawnmowers,
never put it back together.
Right, but I could never get it back together. How did you?
I had a workshop manual, and I just read the sucker.
So you had a manual.
Yep.
You went
and
down
I blew the thing apart because I grew up in my dad's parts department.
That's good.
Going through the old.
Right.
microfiche machines. You remember the old microfiche? Mm-hmm. So that's how I learned Porsche parts, was going through there. I would pull the microfiche. I'd put it in there. I'd look for a part. You know, at the time, it was like a Sebring exhaust.
So much fun.
And I'd pull it, you know, Sebring exhaust.
On figure
and I'd look at the little figure
line,
and I'd blow it up.
Like,
and
where
then
do I find that?
I'd get the part number. And then I'd go back in my dad's warehouse and I'd find that part, right?
Oh, wow.
It was like treasure hunting at 6 years old, you know?
That's great.
So I was just kind of like – I just fell in love with like parts and mechanical stuff. And so I started rebuilding engines, and then I got hired by a Top Fuel drag racing team when I was 12 years old.
Hey, kid, work around these highly flammable objects.
So, and we're only going to pay you
We'll pay you in cigarettes, kid.
Yeah. So literally, that's the way it was. It was like Bad News Bears. It was all of us.
But you're flipping out, right? Because
I was flipping
out. Because these cool guys who drag race want you to work for them.
Absolutely.
It's the greatest.
So a guy named Tom Topping, who actually used to own the building that
– what do they want you to do for them?
I was the left side engine mechanic. So I tore apart the left side of the engine and then put it back together at 12.
Wow.
And then by 13, our team was Nostalgia Top Fuel Drag Racing Champions. And then following year, we were hired by a team that had just bought Shirley Muldowney's 86 car. And we ran it in HRA in 97.
Wow. So, 87, so when you're rebuilding the left side of the engine, where are you doing this? In your dad's shop, or is there some shop with them, or
this
you're
is
on
at,
the
this
track?
Is at, this is at Fremont Drag Race.
You're there at the track, right?
You know, we were either at Fremont or Seattle or wherever the
so
race was, Pomona.
You're traveling with a bunch of dudes at 12?
I was traveling with a whole motorhome full of dudes.
What's going on with school?
So there was a guy named Tom Topping that
No parents, no anything. You just hopped in a van with some weird dudes.
With a whole band of mechanics.
Wow,
have you ever
fun.
Been to the Long Beach High Performance Swap Meet?
Yeah, I actually have.
So that was started by Tom Topping. And Tom Topping was the crew chief and owner of our team. So when I was 12, he hired me to travel with him and his team, and I would travel all over the country building drag race engines.
Wow.
And so I fell in love with the actual like racing side of things. And then by 14,
I can't imagine letting my 12-year-old start traveling with a group of guys around the country. I mean, what is that even like? What are they getting you a hotel room and you check in and go down at the bar and have a cigarette with everybody?
I didn't smoke. I didn't drink, but I definitely had a great time.
That's the deal. When you're that age and you're hanging out with all these older cool guys, don't you feel like you've been made?
Absolutely.
You're totally made at that moment.
Well, but it also
– getting away with murder, right?
It also helped mature me, and I learned life skills, and I was traveling around racing, and then – there came a point where I'm like, you know what?
What about the girls? Were there girls?
There were girls everywhere, but you know, they're 14 years old, right?
But you're this good-looking 12-year-old kid.
Well, good looking
girls making money.
Don't you remember what that's like when you're in? I used to work, you know, I used to bar back in bars, but sometimes I would be, you know, I think 16 or 17 years old. You're always this young guy in this situation where and the girls loved it.
Well,
they just
but
loved
you
it.
Said good looking, but remember this was 1986, 87, so I had long
you
hair
had a mullet?
And full on. Well, when we were drag racing, I had you know a fullet, you know it was all long, you know.
That's a completely different guy. And did you guys win? Were there big losses or the left side of the engine blow and they would
all
blame the 12-year-old?
Absolutely.
Would they go, what are you doing?
Well, so why
did we hire this? Sixth grader.
No. So get this.
To fix the engine.
So get this. So. The entire crew were 12 to 15 years old.
Come on.
So our driver was a
like
guy.
A Siegfried and Roy fantasy.
Did I not tell you that it was like Bad News Bears, right? So Tom Topping had a son, Gene. He was the bottom side mechanic. He was my age. We went to school together. And then another kid, Jason Oliver, that now runs the high performance swap meet, he was the right side mechanic. And then I was the left side mechanic. And so we were three guys that were 12 to 15 years old traveling around the country. And we were Nostalgia Top Fuel Drag Racing Champions, winning everything because we practiced harder, we worked harder, and Tom would run us through drills. So we had a garage in Tribuco Canyon where every day after school we'd come home from school and he would drill us on tearing the engine down and putting it back together and teaching us, you know, what to look for. And so in 45 minutes from a hot pass, you know, running 692 in a front engine top fuel dragster, we could bring the car into the pit, we could tear it down hot, put fresh rings, pistons back in, fuel system back on, chute packed, clutch redone, and done in 45 minutes, ready for the next run.
Incredible.
And so it was just this – this kind of culture.
Did you ever get injured, burned?
All the time. My hands were calloused as a kid.
You could touch a hot engine.
I could touch a hot engine.
You could touch anything. All
so
right.
So anyways.
We're talking to Rod Emery. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back with more Spike's Car Radio. When you're looking to buy a car, you want to make sure that you're getting real pricing on actual inventory. Unfortunately, a lot of times, this isn't the case. People configure cars online only later to find out they're not available. This just happened to my brother. Well, with TrueCar, you get real pricing on actual inventory. This is not pricing offered by TrueCar, but pricing from an actual dealer. And not just any dealer, but a TrueCar certified dealer. This is a carefully curated network of dealers committed to transparency and offering you a competitive market price. Using TrueCar, you can easily find the car you want. Next, TrueCar will show you what other people in your area paid for the same car you're looking for. Now you know what a fair price is, so you can feel confident. And don't we all want to feel confident? Over 3 million cars have been sold to TrueCar users by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network. There are over 13,000 TrueCar Certified Dealers nationwide. You will work directly with a TrueCar Certified Dealer contact. TrueCar users are more likely to enjoy a fast buying process when they connect with TrueCar Certified Dealers. TrueCar users save an average of over $3,000 off MSRP. When you're ready to buy, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. And guess what? I'm not telling you what features and what states.
Hey, my name is James Petragallo.
I'm Jimmy Wisman.
Please join us every single Tuesday for Crime in Sports.
So fun.
You like sports?
You don't have to.
Let's just set up a context and find out what an idiot did wrong. What
I
do
like
you say?
It. I'm in.
We're going to do that each and every week. We take an athlete, we break him down, we make fun of everything he's ever done.
Yeah. But in order to do that, we have to build up and tell you all about their career and get you to what, James? To grace.
And then watch them fall from grace.
Who
as
doesn't
they inevitably
like that?
Do. Join us. Big criminals, small criminals, sports you've never heard of, doesn't matter. It's the crime, it's the comedy, it's such a good time. Join us every Tuesday for Crime in Sports.
You can join us every Tuesday at PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, or subscribe on all Apple products.
Find us every Tuesday and laugh at people.
You're listening to Spike's Car Radio.
All right, we're back with Rod Emery from Emery Motorsports and the Real Zuckerman and me, of course, Spike Ferriston from Spike's Car Radio. We were chatting. You know, whenever I throw in a commercial break, everybody relaxes and they really start talking. And Zuckerman and Rod Emery are in a bromance right now. They've never met. They have a little Instagram girly accounts, and they're all excited to meet each other.
Yes.
And I've just learned that I haven't been to Rod Emery's new shop. I was at your Burbank shop. And I was blown away. And there's now something bigger and better.
We're two miles down the road.
Right.
We just we moved in. And
Before I get into that, I just want to Emery Motorsports, what is your mission statement for the people who don't know who you are, Rod?
To continue to save every Porsche 356 and models that I get my hands on, and to just continue to evolve and build cars that people want to drive.
You're a builder, and your primary builds are Porsche Outlaws, right?
Correct.
Do you restore cars back to preservation cars, or are you just doing Outlaws? Are you bespoke, or what is it?
Yeah, what is it? Well, we build about 12 cars a year, and 10 of those, you know, on average are all 356 Outlaws or Emery Specials, which are, you know, kind of the cars that I'm known for. But we always have one or two special projects that I'll do, that I'll take a car exactly back to a point in time.
Right.
You know, there's plenty of guys out there that do an amazing job building full Concours 356 C Coupes. That's not the space that I'm in. But, you know, the last one of the last cars I restored was the first Porsche race car and the first Porsche to win the 24 Hours of Le Mans.
That's
so
the Gamund car, right? The 356 SL.
Yeah.
So I've seen a lot of that car.
I took that car exactly back to how it raced in 1951.
That's a pretty big cherry that you got that commission.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I'm sure there were a few other guys out there that would have given their all.
You know, I've made a major
that.
Contribution to that restoration.
Yes,
really?
You did.
A very giant one, if not the
biggest
contribution.
I was there.
Contribution.
I was there when you did
and
that.
And I have a special text. I have a special, you know, little, you know.
Tell everybody about what happened, because it was so. It was such a funny little moment.
You have a picture of me that same night laying.
I do.
Yes.
I do have a picture that I keep very special here on
that
my
was,
phone, and someday I'll put it up on Instagram for everybody to see. I'm pulling it up right now so you can see it. This is, I believe, Rod, here you can look at this picture. Is that the picture you're talking about?
Yes, that
this
is the
picture. This is Zuckerman in all his splendor laying
so
back,
good.
Pointing and telling us why he's right and wrong about everything.
And that was about
we love this picture of him, and you can see the beautiful Porsches in the back.
Yeah.
It's in Jerry's hangar, Hangar 9, the
Very
porn
cool.
hangar, by the way. We call it the porn hangar because before Mr. Seinfeld took possession, they were shooting pornographic movies. movies in the hangar. And I was lucky enough to be able to tour it. I've been at the airport for 20 years. I didn't know this was going. There were 10 showers in it, little rooms, and then showers right next to
disgusting.
Them. And they'd been just cranking out porn for decades in there, and now it's Seinfeld's. Anyway, this is the day that we were going through a little book of pictures, and I'll let you pick it up from right there because we found a picture of a very special car in there.
Yeah, what an amazing day that was for me. So this was about 3 or 4 weeks before Pebble Beach 2016.
Right, right, that's right.
And I'd been on a journey of discovering and then restoring Porsche's first race car and the first Porsche to win the 24 Hours of Le Mans. And, you know, there's very limited information about that car.
That's right. And if you want to have a look at it, everybody, it's on his Instagram feed. It's got a 4 and a 6 on it. Yeah. You'll see it. Silver. All right.
Amazing car. And you know, the history was lost. You know, there were 4 cars that were built so that they could start the testing and then show up at Le Mans in 1951. And one of the cars was totaled and destroyed. And then the other 3 were prepared. But only 2 went to Le Mans in 1951. And of those 2, the number 47 car crashed in night practice, so it never made the start of the race. And the number 46 car was the winner. Then after that, the cars were brought back to the factory, and they were re-prepared, and the cars were then eventually sold to the United States. So in 1952, the cars came to the U.S.,
as customer cars. They didn't waste anything back then.
Well, they needed money. They needed cash. You know, they were a small, starving little car company.
When you say they were customer cars, they were sold to customers by a dealer?
So, yeah, the 3 cars that had been prepared for Le Mans, Max Hoffman imported them into the United States. They got here in January of 1952. Max sold the 3 cars. One of them went to Mexico to compete in the La Carrera Panamericana. That was chassis number 54. One of them stayed on the East Coast to race, which is chassis number 55. And then chassis number 63, which is the car that I restored, was brought to the West Coast. And John von Neumann was one of those Porsche dealers that I was talking about, little Porsche dealerships all over the Southern California
basin.
These
are the titans of the early racing days, all these names.
Yeah, John von Neumann had Competition Motors on Ventura Boulevard
right.
in Studio City,
mm-hmm.
and or whatever they called it then, Studio City now. But he was a race car driver, and he took this little 356 SL, raced it 3 times. He raced it at Golden Gate Park. Well, he raced it first at the Pebble Beach Road Races. Then,
can you imagine?
Then Torrey Pines.
Can you imagine the Pebble Beach, those trees, that road, and that car, Zuckerman? We're
glory
up there bombing
days,
around.
Glory
the glory days,
days,
right?
Yeah.
It
was amazing.
Moly.
Little tiny tires and hay bales, you know?
Yeah.
So he raced it 3 times, Pebble Beach, Torrey Pines, and Golden Gate Park. And then he's like, I got to make this thing lighter and faster. So he took it over the hill, Hollywood Boulevard. There was a
How light is it at that point anyways, though?
1,350 pounds, right?
And he's got to make it lighter.
Yeah, and he's going to make it lighter. So
right. A modern-day Porsche is what, about – the light 3, ones are 3,000 pounds, right? Yeah,
so this thing's like 1,400 pounds.
Right.
So he's going to make it lighter and faster. So
and what's the horsepower of a car like that at that point, 50 or 60?
45 horsepower.
45.
So there was a coach builder on Hollywood Boulevard, Emil Diet.
He was a famous guy.
He was a famous guy.
Duesenbergs.
Yeah.
Some
amazing
stuff,
right?
Yes.
So Emil, John von Neumann takes the little 356 SL to Emil and says, cut the roof off. So they cut the roof off. They cut the rear deck lid out. They remove the dash, and they made it look like, you know, a spider, as mm-hmm. close to it as possible. And then von Neumann continued to race it as a convertible. And then in 1956, a guy named Chuck Forge purchased the car. And he owned it from 1956 until he died in 2009.
Wow. Whoa.
And I had known Chuck, most of my life, going to the Monterey Historics mm-hmm. and putting my head in his deck lid opening and looking at the car.
What was he doing with the car? Was he keeping it to himself or was he
racing
it
at the Monterey Historics every single year?
So it was out there.
Every single year.
Did he know it was a Le Mans car?
No.
He did not?
No.
What did he think it was?
One of the SLs that came to the U.S. He had a hunch that it was one of 3 cars.
Right.
The winning car was definitely one of those 3 cars, but nobody knew which one because, for one, there was no documentation on chassis numbers that said which car was number 46, 47, or the other car.
So then how do you verify it?
Well, that's where I come in. So, and that's where the story for me really begins.
Mm-hmm.
The 46 car was a car that I loved as a child, as a kid. I'm growing up in my dad's parts building and, you kind of gravitate towards certain cars. And
mm-hmm.
The number 46 car was a car that I've always just admired. When I built my first car when I was 14 years old, it was a 53 coupe. and I modeled it after the 46 car. I split the windshield, which a 53 doesn't have a split windshield. Mm-hmm. And it also has external bumpers, right? So my first car that I built, I split the windshield. I put body bumpers on it. I drilled holes to put fog lights in the front. I put hood straps on it and built a vintage race car that was like my version of the number 46 car.
How close was it?
Well, it wasn't a replica. It was just inspired by it.
Where is this car right now?
I donated it to charity in 2010. That's
so
a whole other story. It still exists.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool.
I've always been a kind of a student of that car, right? And the early Porsche stuff. And when people say, oh, Rod, you know, you build Outlaws. Well, I'm really just building cars just like Porsche did when they built their race cars in the early days, making them lighter, making them faster, better lights, you know, better drivability. So at the races – at Monterey Historics all every year, I'd go and, you know, one of the cars that I gravitated to was this little 356 Roadster because it was one of the SLs. And so I started kind of looking at it and I'm like, there's something different. And one of my clients loved that car, which is the owner of the 356 SL, Cameron Healy. And we said, man, someday we got to own that car. And when Chuck Forge was alive, he says, I'm going to keep it until the day I die. Well, when he passed away, his estate contacted a few people, possibly even your buddy Jerry. I don't know. But I was one of those first calls. When they said, Rod, Chuck Forge's car is for sale, I said, we'll take it.
And just, it. Just like that?
Just like that.
Wow.
We'll take it.
I wish I could ask the question, but I'm not.
No, you – yeah. No. Go ahead. He's not going to answer.
It's gauche. It's gauche. I want to know.
It's not. What was it? What was the number?
What was it? Well, I can't disclose exactly what the number was, but
– was it seven figures?
It was near seven, right?
Oh, so what a bargain. Oh, my God.
Well, it was – you know –
But still, you think about what you're getting at that point. You're getting a lot of – there's some question marks.
It's a modified race car.
It's a modified race car, right? It doesn't have its original engine anymore?
Right. No.
Of course not.
No?
Yeah.
So you're rolling the dice.
So here we are. You know, here's a car that that we had a hunch was one of the Le Mans winning cars. And my client.
A hunch. Money on a hunch.
My good friend Cameron Healy says, you know, Rod, let's dig deep. Let's figure out what this car is. Let's see if we can discover the history. And got together with guys like Dirk Lair and everybody else that I knew. And then I made a call to
imagine if they said it's a Toyota MR2. What?
I made a call
to
as many friends as I had that had Gamoon cars. Right. Dave Sealand had a 52 Le Mans SL.
Did you call Miles Jerry's Collier? Got one?
Yep.
How many of these Gamoon cars are there's that guy in Sweden?
Who's
that guy we met, Zuckerman, that had a bunch
seven
of them?
Seven or eight, yes.
He said seven or eight.
Probably
Gamoons?
Robert Brocker or –
maybe. Yeah. I don't know.
There's not very many. But you know, there were 50 chassis numbers or serial numbers.
Them? What are you saying? Like –
Can I come and take a look at your car?
And what are you looking for? Welds or?
So Miles Collier's car is the number 55 car. So it was one of the sister cars to this.
Okay.
So I asked Miles if I could come and 3D scan the car and dig deep and find out as much information as I could because I was going to restore this one.
Right.
I've known Miles my whole life. When he bought the Briggs Cunningham collection, he was storing some of the cars at my dad's shop. So I met him when I was about 9 or 10 years old. And so, you know, kind of kept. So when I reached out to him, he said absolutely, and he let
How
me come
do you 3D
and
3D scan a car. What are you doing there?
You use a 3D scan. We've got a couple different versions. We've got a Ferro arm, which is like a big, you know, 6 foot arm that you can that you can wave over the thing.
Can you 3D scan a person?
Absolutely. Yeah.
We want we want cardboard cutouts. This is what we want to send to the LA car show instead of ourselves.
We can 3D scan him and we can 3D print him.
Why are we sending them?
I don't want to go, but I want pictures there.
You don't have to go. They don't care.
Picture there.
Right. Well, anyway, so you start to become reasonably confident that this is the car you thought it was.
How?
Yeah. What is the moment, the eureka moment?
Was the smoking gun or guns?
Well, there were 14 physical characteristics that I discovered that made us 100% confident that this was the Le Mans winning car.
Oh, so wait a second. Does Porsche agree with you now?
Haven't told them yet that we're doing this. Okay.
No,
so we have
now,
the car.
These days, today.
So, we have this document with all this physical evidence, and then Jeff Zwart, reached out to Porsche and said, you guys have this really cool event coming up, RenSport 2015, and you're promoting the Legends of Le Mans, and it's going to be a display with the 919 that had just won, the 917, which is the first overall winner. He says, what are you going to do about the first win at Le Mans? And they said, well, we'll bring the museum car, which is a representation of that. It wasn't the winning car. And he said, how about the car that won? And they said, well, tell us more.
Wow.
So he presented my package of documentation to them. They reviewed it. They put out a press release a week later, and it was beyond a shadow of a doubt.
Wow.
The first Porsche race car, the first car to win the 24 Hours of Le Mans.
And ka-ching.
And so at that point, but this is
–
The money.
Jesus,
I can't stop thinking about it.
So here, this
I want to strangle him.
Money.
Give me some money.
No, come on.
He doesn't own the car.
I don't know. Come on.
If you kill him, you still don't own
the
car.
So this is 9 months.
Get to the guy I need to kill.
We were there. We saw it.
I know. I remember.
This was 9 months before RenSport.
And you were not quite there.
And there was no – quite there.
I
hadn't put the roof on it.
There's no roof, Zuckerman. It's just a hollow husk. It's a wheelbarrow.
Yeah.
So, it's a wheelbarrow.
So Zwart says,
potted plant.
Zwart says, hey, Rod, can you pull this off? And I said, absolutely. So
that's
so
the 20, right answer. So if you're 20, listening, if anybody challenges you, always say that, especially someone you say, yeah, I can do it. And then go home, close the door, and then freak out. But that's such a recipe for success. I've heard that over and over again, right?
Yep.
Don't tell the truth in that moment. Just get it done.
Well, so we had – Porsche said that's fine. And we told them that we were going to display it in bare aluminum and bare steel so that everybody could really see the true car and see that it wasn't just a replica.
Uh-huh. And that was really because you weren't going to be able to finish it.
Yeah. I mean there was no way that we were going to be able to finish
course,
it.
Yeah, of course.
And we didn't want to shortchange the restoration. We wanted to do it right. But I knew that we could get it in a state that it could be a complete representation of the car. And we displayed it at Monterey at Laguna Seca.
It was beautiful.
And everybody fell in love with it again, just like they did when it won.
And explain to everyone how I saved the day.
I'm getting there because that's 12 months later, right? So now the car is in restoration, and RenSport reunion goes, and then everybody says, we got to have this thing at Pebble Beach in 1 year. So I've got to now get this car. We're not just building a race car. Now we're taking it exactly back to a point in time, right?
And is the owner saying to you, whatever it takes,
Rod,
I don't
do
care what
do.
This costs, just
it wasn't it. About money. This was about preserving history.
Right.
And,
well, it's always about money.
Said,
I mean, you're doing an awful lot of work.
Yeah.
But he just gave you carte blanche to do whatever you want.
Well, it was Cameron was my first client. I started building cars for him in 1993.
Right.
So this is a long-standing relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So there's never a question of, because I've always taken care of him. He's always taken care of me.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, let's get this car done. Let's do it exactly the way that it needs to be, and let's get it right.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to pick an exact point in time to restore the car, which was Le Mans, because race cars evolve, right? They change.
Exactly.
Every race, the car is different. So we chose Le Mans 1951. But there's only a handful of pictures. There's only a handful of documentation.
Right.
There's very limited information. And Cameron went to the Porsche archives. They gave him what they had. I scanned everybody's cars. I dug through everybody's history. Jerry let me come and peel the carpet back on his car and
what
really.
What does Porsche have as far as files like from 1951? When you say they go into their archives, what does that look like? Is that like a Manila folder that they open up?
No, at the museum they've got an amazing archives department.
They do. And is it micro? How does it come to you?
Photographs and digital stuff. They're digitizing everything. I've never been there, but
so was your sense that they're now collecting that stuff and putting it in files, or that all along they've been keeping records like this? Because my sense of them is they weren't really keeping good records back then, right?
They weren't really keeping good records. They were a small company that was building cars in a barn, and stuff was getting moved from building to building. And
so now they're kind of feverishly putting all that together, so it'll be
A lot of the files from the 50s were burnt in a fire. I don't know the details of the fire, but there was a lot of records and pictures and documentation that disappeared in the 50s. And so it was a challenge, a big challenge. And I had to recruit a lot of the guys at Porsche, Thorsten Klein, Grant Larson, Tony Hatter, all the new Porsche designers that I personally know. They reached out to everybody they knew to get as much information as possible. the only way that we got the interior information was Herbert Linga is the only living person that was on the build team and one of the mechanics back in 51, 52.
Wow.
So he helped us understand what the interior was like, the colors, the type of materials, along with Frank Young, the historian at Recaro, which used to be Reuter. Reuter mm-hmm. was the coach builder, later became Recaro. Frank Young is the historian there. He helped me with a bunch of stuff. But there were still unknowns. I had never seen inside the engine compartment of the car. I had never seen pictures of the number 47 crashed car. We didn't know what the aero plates were underneath the car. So here I am. It's a month before Pebble Beach. I've, you know, literally worked 18 to 20 hours a day from Rennsport Reunion until this point. The car, I'm just finished painting the car. Mm-hmm. It's late July. I'm sitting in my office with my son, and I said, Zane, I said, I'm about to drill holes that are either going to make or break me. And he says, well, what do you mean? And, you know, so we're kind of, I said, I got to figure out what the components were, the orientation, the configuration on the firewall of the engine compartment. And I need to know what the aero plates look like underneath the car. I said, and I'm stressed to the max. And so we start doing research. It was not even a half an hour after that conversation with my son. I mean, it was the most surreal situation I've ever had in my life. Let me mm-hmm. just put it to you that way. It's a moment. You have 5 or 10 things in your life that are like a defining moment or something that you'll never forget.
Mm-hmm.
It was a text that I received from some nutcase that doesn't
sitting
even
across
that
from you.
He's not in my. You know, I've never been privileged enough to have his phone number, and
I'm on the other side of town smoking a cigar,
and drinking Diet Coke, just laughing, having fun. So here, my son and I are sitting there trying to figure out because I've got to drill holes.
Right?
And less than a month later, this car is going to roll out on the lawn, and whether they're going to figure it out or not, but they could have a picture that I don't have. Right.
Right.
So here I am, stressed out, and I get this text, and boom, it's an engine compartment picture. And I look at Zane, and I just drop my phone. And then boom, another photo shows up. And then I think I can almost quote what I said. I said, these pictures are amazing. Who is this?
Right.
And where did you get these? And then boom, boom, more pictures. And I said to Zane, I said, somebody – and I don't cuss.
Right.
I said, somebody is effing with me right now. But and he looks at me and he says, Dad, he goes, this is so crazy. I don't know what's going on.
It was
right?
really crazy.
And we're going back and forth.
Really
and then
crazy.
And then the next message was, it's Spike and Jerry. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me.
It was so funny. Now, on our side of it, we were just going down to smoke cigars in the porn hangar. And Jerry's like, hey, look at this book I just found. I think I've had this for 15 years.
He's got this whole trove of stuff.
And he goes, I'm pretty sure. He goes, look at this, Spike. I'm pretty sure this is the car Rod's working on.
Oh, my gosh, it looks like it.
Do you think I should offer it to him? He goes, yeah, I don't care. Go take a picture. So we started sending you pictures. I'm not going to tell him who it is. And we'll see if he can figure it out, the car and who it was. But, boy.
Unbelievable.
We were blown away when we realized that you needed to see that. We were all floored by it.
I cannot believe that this
picture book bubbled up into Seinfeld. You know, he's flying around in a plane every other day, right?
Okay.
So he just happens to walk in his hangar full of crap and find that. And there's a lot of crap there.
A lot of crap.
And he brings that and that alone to the cigar smoke. He goes, hey, look at this.
He's got a whole shipping container of this stuff.
And he happens to stumble across this.
Beyond a shipping container. Yeah, it's every hangar is loaded with crap.
Unbelievable.
Right.
So, okay. So,
including some very special wedding photos.
We can't talk about this.
So from my standpoint, here I am. I am floored, blown away, super excited. And then reality hits. Because I'm looking at these photos.
Right.
The ones that you had sent me, which were of an engine compartment. And I just said to Zane, I said, this is terrible.
It's all wrong?
I said, this is terrible. I said, I've got all this new information. I said, but now I've got to change a ton of stuff. And I've only got 3 weeks to do it. So Jerry says, you know, I'm going to send the book over to you.
Mm-hmm.
And he had, Gianni get it together. And then my dad went and picked it up and brought it to me. Luckily, it was loaded. The pictures you had sent me, fortunately for me, were not of that engine compartment.
Oh,
although, it was right next to a picture of our car in the book.
Oh, there you go.
Right? So that's why for you, you see the picture of the car in the book with the dude standing outside.
Yeah.
It looks like there's bullet holes in the side of the car.
That's right.
And then there was an engine picture right next to it, but that wasn't the engine compartment for this car. There's a number of reasons
What was that a photo book from?
Okay. My best guess, that is not public information. Those
are personal photos.
Those photos were personal, and that was a gift or something from somebody within to another person in Porsche, because there was a lot of top secret stuff. Mm-hmm. There were photos of the crash car of every single angle, which solved my aeroplate situation.
Oh, there you go.
That book revealed probably, no joke, 50 details that I was able to apply or confirm on the restoration.
Right, right.
Because I was now able to see – it was like having X-ray vision, because here's the number 47 car smashed on every corner, which nobody's ever seen those photos, smashed on every corner. And I can see inside the fender that's ripped off and the aeroplate's pulling down. So now I can see inside the car.
Right.
It was like having an X-ray scan of the cars, right?
It's amazing.
So I found out all these details, but more importantly, what that book did for us is it helped us confirm on a completely another level that this car was for sure the Le Mans winning car. But it also gave me the information that I needed to prove which car was the number 47 car.
Right.
And which car was the test car, and which car was the Liège-Rome-Liège car, which car was the Montfleury 1500cc car.
It's amazing.
This is proof, by the way,
that there's a God and he likes Porsches.
Right.
So
that he's a Porsche fan. So, because why else would that have happened?
It unbelievable. So
is Miles, Porsche aware now of this of the significance of the book?
No.
They are now.
They are now. This book, no, I haven't told anybody about the book because—
Who has it? Do you still have it?
No, I don't have it. I returned it.
Well, Jerry's going to lose it. You better get it back.
Well,
Jerry did
let me do a full documentation scan of the book for my own personal use.
Good.
Okay. But I've never mentioned the book publicly, but
until
you brought
today.
It up because you were the one. So, but yes, the book is very significant, and I hope that someday Jerry will collaborate with me and let me either, you know, co-write something with him and share the gold that's in there on Porsche's history, because it is unfreaking believable. Not just on those three cars, but also a handful of other things that I would love to share with him sometime.
Yeah.
But
so do we know who ended up with the crashed car?
I do.
Can you say?
No. I can't hear. I really don't think we should because it's something that I know
there's
the details.
There's more coming. There's more to the story.
There's
we have
so
beautiful
much
things
more.
To look forward
there
to.
Is so
and
much
I
would
if I owned the crash car, I wouldn't give a crap. Right?
It is unbelievable what's in that book. And you know, so Miles Collier knows that the book exists and you know has
the
asked
book.
Has
the
asked
book. I'm gonna call this episode the book. I had no idea that this book was so important. Or that it was a secret.
You should go back in time, read it in the bathroom.
We should go
wasn't that called the book?
We're gonna the bookstore.
The bookstore.
That was George. We should we're gonna see Jerry this weekend, Zucker.
I think this book is the missing link.
Ask him to bring the book.
No, we'll ask him to bring the book tomorrow
to
coffee.
Yes,
you should.
Okay.
You will be blown away.
This is
good
because I'm gonna wrangle Seinfeld into doing the next podcast. So we'll run that episode right after this, and we'll start with talk about.
Did
the
you
book.
Ever spend
now we
any,
have a reason
and
to,
where the book came from and some of the other
yes yeah. and some of the other books he's in possession of
yes.
So
like the wedding,
the way that book was put. You asked about the book. The way the book was put together, it's amazing. It's handcrafted.
Mm-hmm.
It's got an emblem on the front.
Yeah.
You open it up. It's got rice paper in between the photos, like each page. But it is just the people, the clothing they're wearing,
the
details in the buildings, the photos. There's a photo in there. I'll talk about. I'll talk about one photo that was unbelievable. It's a photo in the Reuter factory in 1951 when they were assembling these cars, and they're all the Porsche guys were standing around a little cabriolet, and right behind it, I can see the louvered quarter window of the car, and I can see it assembled, which is just it's those moments. I mean, every page I turned, hair stood up on my arms.
Wow.
It
just,
it's so
well. There you go. There was I asked everybody if they wanted to ask questions of Rod Emery today, and I'm sorry we didn't get to him. But someone did say, "What makes the hair on your arms stand up?" I want to know, Rod. What makes and you just heard it. Well, we're out of time, man. This was excellent.
Greatest
we could
story
go on
ever.
For another 2 or 3 hours. You got to come back at some point and we'll talk more Porsches. In the meantime, follow Rod Emery on Instagram. He's awesome, and I follow you there. I saw the Smash GT3 RS. And
I pick it up tomorrow.
Huh?
It's
you
done.
Do?
It's fixed.
Done finally.
Fixed,
there
yep.
you go. That makes me happy. Yep. That must have been a horrible accident, but we'll talk about that next time. Zuckerman is at The Real Zuckerman, and he just keep in mind, he's a miscreant. He's a vile human being, so if he contacts you on Instagram, don't respond. And I'm at Spike First, and you can say hello to me, too. This is Spike's Car Radio. We'll see you next week, hopefully, with Seinfeld and Zuckerman and myself out in Malibu.
Thanks for listening to Spike's Car Radio. Download new episodes every Wednesday on the Podcast One app or subscribe now at Apple Podcasts or PodcastOne.com.